Today, for Always Record, episode 161, we are joined by Gordon White of runesoup.com. That's runesoup.com. While Gordon's work should be familiar to many of you, and if you're not familiar with his work, you should definitely check it out. There's another reason to be excited about today's show. This interview also is essentially conducted by the original Always Record trio. That means Bill Klaus, David Plate, and myself, Alan Green, are here today with Gordon White. This is a really pleasurable conversation. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Always Record number 161. Here we go.
Hello, hello.
Hello, Gordon.
How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for joining us so early in the morning.
Oh, it's all good.
Do you have a dark roast coffee, an espresso? What is your means of caffeine?
Well, we just moved into this place, so I bought a plunger coffee thing from IKEA the other day because all our fun toys are still kind of on a boat in the middle of the Indian Ocean.
Oh, well, that's exciting. Fingers crossed for that safe arrival.
Yeah. Hopefully it's not like a Malaysia Airlines situation, because I have one or two nice things. We're effectively camping at the moment. So I'm sitting on a couch in an empty room, using the box from said couch as my desk.
Well, it's a little bit of a throwback then.
It feels very terroristy.
Like you're in a sleeper cell on some
level. Yeah.
I just wanted to introduce you, Gordon. My name is Bill. We've never talked before. On the line is Alan Green, who pretty much is the rock of SyncBook and SyncBook Press. And we have David Plate. So you can say hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hello. And I want to say, David, if I'm the rock, David is definitely the water and the fire or something like that.
I was going to say the role, but... Gordon, the way I want to do this, I'm basically hijacking Always Record today. They've been so gracious to let me come in as a guest. I want to just spend a quick few minutes sketching out a quick profile of your work and what I know of you, so we can kind of dig into a nice conversation.
For sure.
All right. Gordon White is probably best known for the Rune Soup blog out there. If you haven't checked it out, I highly recommend it. You were born in Australia, correct?
Yes, I was. Born and raised.
Born and raised. Then you moved to London, and now you're back home in the land of Oz.
There was also a brief six-year detour to New Zealand before moving to the UK about 8 and a bit years ago, and I've been back in the homeland for about 3 weeks.
I've heard a few interviews with you, and I just want to kind of get some of that. There's many interviews out with Gordon. You'll find out from this interview, he's very lucid, very well-spoken, but I want to kind of get into the deeper stuff. You kind of woke up from a profound dream as a young man and stole some money from your mom and bought some magical books and kind of took off from there. Kind of came of age magically in the 90s. With Graham Hancock, Grant Morrison, finding a particular resonance with Peter Carroll and Chaos Magic. Would that be fair?
Yeah, that's definitely a briefer way of describing it than I have before, but it's certainly accurate.
The only reason I kind of have brevity there is sometimes when you're interviewed, you kind of spend time going over the same things. There are other interviews out there for people to check into, not to slight your personal history.
No, that was a compliment. That was I need to learn how to compress that down myself.
So you're known as or self-identify as a chaos magician. I like the way that you kind of describe how if you think magic is a route to spiritual apotheosis or salvation, then you are using magic for the wrong reasons. That magic, as you say, is to find the things that optimize all the worlds, as I've heard you quoted, and just basically looking for things that work.
Yeah, it's the path of a meddler rather than a mystic, because it requires you to sort of pick at things and see if it works better and sort of be permanently unsatisfied with how things are going. In some of Pete Carroll's more recent books, and I mean, it's a bit mean, but it's if the shoe fits, when he's referring to other sort of Western magical groups, there's very often a tendency to use a claim of mysticism as a cover for lack of results. And Chaos Magic's strength, and frankly, its limitation, is its fixation on results. You either get them or you didn't. It's binary.
My personal, this is the way I've been carrying Chaos Magic in my mind. I just wanted to throw it out there and see what you would think of it. Chaos Magic seemed to have really took off in the early 80s. It seems like the 80s was the decade for Chaos Magic to kind of establish itself and kind of carve out its own specific territory. And I kind of, this is how I visualize it. Punk music arose in the late 70s, and I kind of feel as if there is a connection to the punk rock ethos and Chaos Magic. Putting it on a spectrum, punk music can be just three people picking up instruments and going to a garage and affecting a cause, to the other end of a spectrum being ceremonial magic, which would be a symphony orchestra. Do you feel like there's any value in painting that spectrum in that way?
Yeah, I would say there is. The Chaos Magic emerged out of a group of sort of Northern English magicians who were in London at the time, which was the 80s, and it's still kind of in the rain shadow of the whole sort of King's Road Chelsea period of the late 70s. London at the time, there were a lot more squats. Social safety net was a lot more rigorous, so you could actually essentially squat and be on some form of government benefit and essentially just be bohemian for a while. And that led to a tremendous amount of experimentation. And it kind of emerged as a reaction to a lot of internecine squabbles in the more thelemic schools of thought that were going on at the time. Like ceremonial magic or Western magic was in a very moribund state coming out of the late 70s and into the early 80s, and there were fights and the usual stuff. And so you just had this group of people called the Stoke Newington Sorcerers who kind of got together in a basement in Stoke Newington, as the name implies, and started experimenting with things. And they did that first, and then the name came later. Pete Carroll says, basically, there's a very famous book in the mid to late 80s by James Gleick called Chaos, which was their sort of first popular chaos mathematics book. And he said, well, let's just call it that. What happened was they self-published a few kind of books that became Pete's early and famous books, and Weiser picked them up late 80s, early 90s and published them, you know, properly and in the US as well. And it kind of took off from there. So it was sort of a second printing side effect.
Are you familiar with the term synchromysticism?
I certainly am.
Do you kind of find some parallel with the arising of chaos magic being defined, being practiced, being a sort of a rejection of the infighting and squabbling, as you had said, with synchromysticism sort of, I kind of feel, as evolving directly out of the internet? And finding a home on the internet, seemingly the dominant tool is the internet with synchromysticism, the ability to cross-reference so many sources so quickly. So do you find any parallels between these emerging entities?
In a way, synchromysticism for me, when it's done correctly, which very often it isn't, is an emergence or a reemergence rather of kind of a new language of image and place. So you have notions like the language of the birds in alchemy and this, or even whatever If you look at when, say, the Kabbalah formed in between the 11th and 13th centuries in Europe, if you look at what the Kabbalah is, it's essentially that same matching of image and resonance and place and interpreting it as a language or a means of communication between people or between God or between place and so on. So communications or technology platforms change, and as that happens, a new way of kind of having that dialogue or the fact that, I mean, Dr. Kripal mentions that it's probably quite important that the universe appears to be linguistically constructed. And I think synchromysticism and, you know, parts of alchemy and parts of the Kabbalah are all different ways in different time periods of describing that same kind of fundamental communication process.
Do you have a pretty extensive background with the Kabbalah, working with it, knowledge base?
Not really. I'm fascinated by it. It just doesn't resonate with me. So I know some of his history, and I years ago read what turned out to be not very good translations of some of the texts. It's not really my stuff. It itself is having a bit of a renaissance over the last 10 years as people have moved away from the sort of Kircher tree diagram that formed the basis of the 19th century Victorian orders, and people have gone back. People outside of a predominantly Jewish tradition have gone back to the original source texts and looked at other sort of Kabbalists through history, and it's having a moment of robustness, but it's just not a thing I resonate with on a practical basis, however much it interests me intellectually.
Where I kind of want to open this up to kind of get everyone involved is a kind of question that I've been having that I think jumps up at this point, is the notion of secrecy. And I guess the defining question I'm wrestling with right now is there any secrecy left in magic? If there isn't, what have we gained by that? And what have we lost by that? Do you find that theme has already been covered, that it's sort of in the past? Or do you think with the rise of the internet, with the rise of instant accessibility of texts that used to cost not only hours to find, but dollars of plenty to actually acquire, and being someone who now has published two books on, you know, Starships, which I just finished, excellent in its research and its historical research, it's beautifully mapped out, and Chaos Protocols, which I have not yet read. What do you feel about secrecy, magic, and all that?
Well, I'll sort of split it into two things. If there's any secrecy left in magic, I'm kind of the opinion that the most important school of magic in a chaos sense, in a chaos definition in the 20th century, was whatever the deep state was perpetrating during the Cold War in some kind of weird MK off and MK Ultra situation, because make no mistake that kind of thing is, you know, a literal definition of magic. So there is secrecy left, not in the more humble and probably more genuine practices of people who would identify as magicians in the West today, but that's still certainly there. As for the role of secrecy, obviously it is, it's historic. So you have the Western magical tradition more or less emerged out of the polyglot sort of late classical New York that was Alexandria, the sort of blending of Egyptian and Babylonian and Hebrew ideas in Alexandria at the time. And we get the Greek magical papyri and so on. So you have a lot of out-of-work priests and people who have now an arm's length or elastic relationship to secrecy at the beginning, because there are secret components to joining a priesthood and so on, but now their temples are no longer there. So there's that piece, and then there's, of course, the fact that you could be burned for it, and people did throughout a big chunk of the Middle Ages. That kind of secrecy is no more. There is probably a, dare I say, esoteric reason for secrecy, which is these things, and it kind of comes back to what we were saying about synchromysticism. If you try to explain something, it's almost like my sensation of it is kind of like pulling something up off the ocean floor and have it kind of rust and deteriorate in your hands when you take it out of the water. It's very difficult to explain something that has been interpreted or experienced, quote unquote, magically. And so that's a big part of what goes on in alchemy. Like if these things were easy to explain as, you know, cooking some rice, which actually I'm not very good at, but if it was as easy as that, then it would be explained that way. But it's not, because we're dealing with a sort of nonlinear mythic language. It doesn't match that sort of more industrial mode of thinking. So that's a big part of the secrecy from an operative point of view. But as for the idea that there are publicly available groups of Western magicians out there that have some sort of inner magical secret that has been passed down mouth to ear through the centuries, that was never the case. That was always an advertising position, and it's certainly not the case today.
I kind of feel like magic is called Cthulhu's bluff. I always associate the myth of Cthulhu as public opinion, the rise of this disconnected force that clearly influences so much of what happens in our world today. And that I'm obviously not explicitly true or black and white true, but I always kind of considered that certain magicians who tap into an art form or into certain workings that to them become so crystal clear, become fearful that they've done all the work and that just about anyone could tap into that if they were able to be introduced to a ritual or into language. But I think we found that just isn't true. Magical yeah. techniques aren't, you can't just reveal a magical technique.
Okay, we're back in business, and I apologize. Go, if you could, Gordon, please start back with your response there.
I would say I agree completely with that. There's no, you can kind of smell people who are bluffing it, and people who are concerned that a certain ritual form is now publicly available. It doesn't. It's like saying the blueprints of a Maserati are publicly available. Like it doesn't really. Yes, they are. It's not going to help. There's no magic is the short circuit. There's no way to short circuit it. You just kind of have to do it or experience it.
You're touching on the distinction between a mystery and a secret, which itself would be the distinction between Kabbalah and a cabal.
Yeah, so absolutely.
Cabal mystery came later. If I may, I'd just like to qualify one point that you were making earlier, which is true in its own right, yet at the same... So you were talking about European Kabbalists and the 12th and 13th century. You have, you know, from Jerusalem, you have Ramak and people giving commentary on Zohar. Zohar emerged in writing around the 12th century, yet it's a reasonable argument to assume it's an oral tradition that existed before then. And the text itself that we're looking at, we don't even really know how old that is, though the general consensus seems to be it could be as early as the second century and before then an oral tradition. Yeah, yeah. Yet that's a debatable point, obviously, admittedly.
It wouldn't surprise me. I think rather than the Jewish tradition isn't, in the last couple of millennia, isn't particularly good with or prefers written to oral traditions. So that's a point against it. But if you look at the kind of things the Zohar describes and covers, I maybe wouldn't go back to second century. I'd go maybe fourth, but it's
that's
certainly
just generally what the yeah. consensus is. On the street. That's
the street Zohar consensus. But it looks like kissing cousins to some of the other texts and concepts that were floating around the Eastern Med in the third and fourth century. So I have absolutely no problem with that idea
it's
at the time.
Egyptian in origin. There's very little question there if you go sure. deep enough into it, you know. So there's that.
But most things are.
Right. And also the Chinese, the parallels are absolutely uncanny. Even tarot itself, we can see independently, apparently, emerged in China and Egypt. And so similar to like the Golden Bough, when you're looking at these, you know, large scale ritual ceremonial actions that people were doing, that was the big thing with the Golden Bough, is they were like, well, this is, we're trying to approach this in as reasonable a way as we can, yet all signs are seem to point to things independently expressing the exact same dynamics to a degree that shouldn't be possible. And yet it's there despite it. And so, you know, tarot is one of those really strange things like that. And Kabbalah certainly is an extension and isn't an exception, or vice versa.
I wanted to kind of connect this to Gordon's book, Starships, I guess, from that point. In Gordon's book, he traces back, I hope I don't bungle this too much, but starting from the temple discovered at Göbekli Tepe, which predate the pyramids by, is it 60,000 years? I'm going to get my map.
No, it's about 8 or 9, depending on where you date the pyramids. But it's sort of it's closer to 9, presuming, because we've only kind of uncovered a few hectares of what's probably a 20-hectare site at Göbekli Tepe. So I think about it in sort of ratios. So if the distance between us and the Great Pyramids is 1 length, it's 2 other pyramid lengths back to Göbekli Tepe.
So the stars and human beings' relationship to the stars, their fascination with them, and how these objects and their architecture in the sky influenced how people lived and how they got together. And by all accounts, the Göbekli Tepe resembles a place of worship, a temple. The importance of that, when it comes to magic, in my estimation, is what Kabbalah is for me, is a way to store an incredible amount of information into a very small space. And if one had, sort of a photographic memory of the stars and their relationships, naturally, memories, places, ideas are all stored in that framework. And that when you store a large amount of information in a small space, that's where magic happens. Because you get density in some place that seemingly is not dense. Thoughts have no density, but yet we all know heavy things. Do you find a connection between star maps as a sort of interface for information storage, in the same sense that Kabbalah is an interface for information storage?
More or less, yes. I think that's a good characterization of the function of stars in pre-literate cultures. The stars were a storehouse and a clock. And also, when you're back in the Ice Age, the thing... for an ice age to work, most of the water on Earth, or a considerable amount more, has to be locked up in ice on the planet. The clue is in the name. What that means is that the sky has less water in it and less cloud cover. So not only is there no actual pollution, light pollution, any of that stuff, there's also very little water in the air, or less water in the air. So it was the only thing on TV. If you've ever been out in the desert, especially if you've been mildly off your face and looked at the stars, that was what was on every night for thousands and thousands of years. And I just find that idea very, very compelling. And so even on a without moving into what I think are the profound implications of the long-running use of star lore as a storehouse and clock for mankind, mm-hmm. even if there isn't something very weird behind that, which I think there is, it of course that's where we would put our stories, and that's how we would time things, because it's stunning now. It would have been more stunning then, and it's not like they had Pokemon Go.
Even down under, people know of the world famous Pokemon Go.
Apparently it got here first. We got it before most of Europe. I think this is one of the trial markets. I don't play it because I'm an adult, but it got here quite early. So Sydney was almost up with it before European cities.
Gordon, maybe we can actually use that as a quick segue, because Pokemon, right, is like this...
Pocket Monster.
Well, sure, but I was going to say... this idea of like the augmented reality, I was actually, the first day it came out here in the US, I was walking with someone who was playing it, and she suddenly like points her phone and, oh my God, it's right there or whatever. And I, of course, I'm not looking through the phone, and I go to look to see where what's there, you know? And it was this experience of like, oh, okay, right. You're seeing something I don't see with the aid of this device. And that to me is an interesting sort of perhaps metaphor for some of these star system mythologies or histories, and that's where I want to sort of get your maybe your expertise with your research. We've heard numerous stories throughout the alternative research community over the last 20 years about things like, say, the Mayans having maps of star systems that we were only able to confirm somewhat recently with, you know, super powerful telescopes. And, you know, their idea is, oh, these in quote unquote invisible beings told us about them, or these beings from the sky came down and told us, they gave us these maps. And we have the same, obviously, the Dogon tribe that was made famous with the Sirius mysteries, you know, all these ideas of people having knowledge of the sky beyond perhaps. Or I guess this is what I want to ask. You gave the idea of the Ice Age having a better view of the sky. Where do you sort of draw that distinction, or where do you weigh in or are able to confirm, deny, all that sort of stuff, these ideas of assisted augmented realities where people were able to have knowledge because they had the proper technology, as it were?
I'll split that into two, because that's what I think are the more interesting implications that I explored toward in the last few chapters of Starships. The first one, the use of Pokemon Go as a metaphor for this kind of thing, to my mind, really only works in a Gnostic sense. I think it's an archonic version of a spiritual experience, because you are using this surveillance device to see something that is there for money, and it's kind of obsessed most of the world at this point. So I tend to prefer a more if there's a spiritual implication to Pokemon Go, it's that needs to be overcome, if that makes sense. But as
that's
for your
product,
yeah, it is. It's the most sort of mark of the beast thing to watch people wandering around looking at these phones for stuff that isn't there, and I'm like, gosh, you want to put on a sack and get a rope belt and start yelling at them. Like, it's very interesting. As for what we're talking about when it comes to the stars and the kind of, and almost like the previous discussion about it, there may be a function of density of thought around a particular asterism or not, but Starships looks at what I think is the imprint of kind of, oh, the observable evidence of something on the other end of the line when you're entangling your consciousness with the stars. And it's what I call sort of redundant complexity. There's a big part of the book that deals with the myth of progress being a myth and a very dangerous one and so on. Nevertheless, you kind of have the sort of uneven distribution of novelty across the human timeline, sometimes more, sometimes less. So other mechanisms of action are in play. And when it comes to cultures that got better and better at essentially entangling their consciousness with the stars, so via measurement or astrotheology or what have you, you see pieces of redundant complexity that aren't explicable in any other way other than there's something about us engaging with the stars in this way that gets, a download of information. Because the Dogon is a very good example. It's not just the fact that they had an understanding of the ratio of the weights of not just the twin stars of Sirius, but what turned out to be the third star in the system, which we only found in the mid-90s. So there's that piece. But also, although some of his conclusions aren't very good, if you look at some of the stuff Laird Scranton's done, some of the depictions of the Nomo match things that you would only like kind of see in a cell with a microscope. So we're getting redundant complexity. Same thing with the ratios of different buildings at the Giza complex and all this stuff, which doesn't work structurally. It doesn't have any kind of use. We've misinterpreted this to think that they had, you know, land speeders and all that kind of stuff. It's weirder than that. It's that we kind of got more in the download than we expected. And the Maya are a good example. Well, they're one example of it. They're probably the best American example of it because you have, even to this day, folklore about precisely that, about different beings that have different star maps that gave them to the Maya and all that kind of thing. I don't know if you've ever read any of Dr. R.D. Sixkiller Clark's books, but she's gone around collecting First Nations stories to do with basically UFOs. And the ones on the one on sort of Mexico or Mesoamerica is incredible because they're just these remarkable stories that persist in folklore today to do with all that kind of stuff.
Can I just ask, I'm sorry, one more just a clarifying question. You keep saying redundant complexity. Are you sort of using that in the sense of like, say, like a Shannon Weaver model or something like that sort of communication theory, like the redundancy is there to ensure that the communication or the gnosis or whatever sort of way you want to paint that is coming through?
No, I mean... there is too much complexity in the message to be explained functionally in a functional version of history. So there are bits that you can functionally explain to do with star lore in mankind. Again, as we were just saying, the stars were the only thing on TV. So obviously they're going to be important. Obviously they're a much more reliable clock than anything else that people who are hunter-gatherers had. So you start to see... the calendrical complexity is functional. The fact that using the stars as a calendar also gives you the shape of the inside of a cell or the mass of three different stars in a star system, that these things are not useful in a hunter-gatherer situation. However, they end up with them. And we've, because of, I guess, the impact of materialism that gave us things like the extraterrestrial hypothesis, for a while, our interpretation of that was that physical beings, physical spacemen landed, spoke to the Dogon, told them about their planet for no, or their star system for no good pointless reason, and then, you know, fucked off. That doesn't seem to work, especially when you look at that complexity in other cultures that sort of double down on astrotheology. They start to learn things that they can't know, and that's the redundant complexity.
I wanted to connect the it's amazing that the Pokemon Go thing is happening, that it's here, that we're talking about it. But it is a phenomenon that obviously has been on all of our radars. I'm the hopeless optimist when it comes to all things in this forum. I always see a silver lining to all of this stuff. But just to make a point about the Pokemon Go mechanic, there's two functions of it that I find that we're sorely lacking in our society, especially for kids who have grown up with the internet, who don't go out record shopping, who don't go out book shopping, they don't have to go out to hunt and gather things, right? And that has been taken from us for a long time, people, city dwellers even. But it was even more pronounced for them. And bringing in a little bit of Marshall McLuhan, that reading things is so print-based that people don't read their environment. They read it in a typographic print sort of way. They don't read it like someone in a forest would read the forest. So what I'm seeing with the Pokemon Go is that you have this – it's a bridge to reading your environment. If you take this sort of map-based, go here, get this right here, if they expand the mechanic to – can you figure out a mystery? Can you locate clues in your environment to find this thing? It's sort of a training wheels for an old school, original based reading of your environment. And it's sort of a hunter gathering kind of instinct. It's taking people who were boxed in and bringing them outside and reawakening these parts of their brain that haven't disappeared. They're just sort of dormant. And to add one layer to that, you have states where recreational marijuana is legal, and you have states where it is illegal. And I just feel like there's something wrapped up in all of that that I find a bridge to some sort of freedom that has been denied a lot of kids who are growing up in our technological prison almost. So,
aren't they bringing the prison with them? I mean, yeah.
Well, the idea is that
they're hunter-gathering, relying on a surveillance device that is shining in their face the whole time. So I guess in the medium, I'm a medium-term optimist, so medium-term glass half full. In the short term, I'm not sure. They're not really learning hunter-gathering. They're learning to rely on their phone outside the house. And that's a fairly alarming in training. It's not like they're off on early 80s BMX bikes or anything. And that's the bit where I may depart from your analysis.
You're seeing a replication, right? Because the same thing is happening with the screen of words that we're relating to our environment through. You could argue that we used to be more right brain dominant, and the way that things come into form, it starts with the right, and the left is the template that replicates the template, so to speak. And so you say, well, what is more connected to the emanated flow or whatever in terms of the emanations, right? So you say, well, we're already replicating something else that's more primary. And so it only makes sense that in form we would then re-replicate that in another extension, and which is like a further removal. Yet paradoxically, it almost points back to what's happening before then. As you see what I'm saying, it's like the same phenomenon is repeating itself in multiple stages of emanation. And so, though you know, in form we're seeing a replication of what we're already doing with our minds. Does that make sense?
And I would take that a step further to say I think that same replication goes down to the double-edged sword of the technology. Gordon, you keep sort of harping on the idea that they're taking this surveillance device around with them. In that respect, I'm with you 100%. I'm not opposed to technology in a lot of ways, but I'm certainly creeped out by the smartphone surveillance system and just the overall technological control grid that's dominating the globe right now. That's usually where my mind first goes. And as these stories have come out about what does this program, what permissions does it require from your phone, how is it tracking you, all this sort of stuff, I think under normal circumstances that would be the perspective that I would sort of gravitate to or fixate on. If it weren't for the fact that, and again, I'm not playing this game, I haven't whatever, but I recently moved to a new city and this game came out. I was out front of my apartment one night smoking a cigarette and some neighbors were deciding that they were going to go out at like 1:30 in the morning to go hunt Pokemon in this new game that they just got for their phones. They were excited about it and I was like, I'll go for a walk with you guys. And what was interesting was to see these people who had lived in the city. For me, it was just an excuse to kind of explore my surroundings that were new to me, but to see even them learning new things where they're like, oh, it says to go down to this fountain on this street. I've never seen a fountain there, and go down there and sure enough, there was a fountain. They're like, oh, wow, I never noticed this before. And then we went to the neighborhood where I was living previously and it was like something about this next stop is at a gazebo. And I was like, no, man, I've been on that corner like 30 times. I never saw a fucking gazebo there. Sure enough, there was a gazebo. And I'm like, okay, what am I? And I think I'm a pretty observant fellow, but this was showing me, A, clearly there's plenty of things that I'm not taking in about my surroundings, and B, just as a tool for sort of learning your landmarks and learning your terrain, that even in the sense, as you say, they're relying on the phone, it actually was, in a very strange and unexpected way, educational, that all of us, both the guy who was new to the city and the people who had been here for quite a while, were learning about their environment as they went. Now, again, similar, let's kind of take this back to your star map theory, in the same way that perhaps the Dogon could not do very much with learning about a distant star system, it probably has very little practical value on their life. Me learning that there's a gazebo down on this corner probably also doesn't have a practical value in that sense, but it was a similar sort of thing. And again, I'm not speaking the praises of Pokemon. I'm even surprised to find myself in this middle territory where I'm seeing both sides of Bill's optimism and your pessimism, because it seems to me it's very obvious both are very, very much in this whole picture.
Well, sure. What you're dealing with there is an artificial psychogeography, though. When, as an animist, I would prefer, a more organic one. But another, you know, hypothetical story would involve a kid wandering off chasing Pokemon, you know, I'm in Australia now, so into the bush. If that kid drops his or her phone and it breaks, lost. All right, there is no there's no hunter-gatherer training there. The idea that we're kind of experiencing the landscape, we're still mediating it with this device, as opposed to exploring the landscape. You know, it's not a this is not a Luddite thing as much as it is an observation that it's filling a need that is obviously there in a way that I'm surprised because it's so unsatisfying compared to you know, potentially doing it in a way that I think has an increased level of depth and authenticity. I mean, I honestly don't care what people do. I just don't think it is a, I don't think it is a play out. If anything, it's a trick to lead us further away from rediscovering kind of hunter-gatherer or psychogeographical modalities because we're not doing it ourselves.
I kind of feel like the situation is so dire that the trickster is using its only known way to try to release or fix the situation. In and of itself, it is something to be rejected. Why are you going outside staring at your phone hunting for imaginary objects? But I think at the end of that plank is you're falling into an ocean where the human being will look up at some point, maybe see other fellow people around them in the water and say, hey, this is all right. So that's my optimism projecting beyond the initial part. So I like I said, I see both sides of the story. I just know that I walk around a lot more than the average person. I live in Chicago. I walk downtown. I walk in the neighborhoods. And over the course of the last 2 weeks, I mean, I have seen the amount of people out in the streets increased by between 400% and 600%. It's undeniable and undeniably weird right now for me to see this many people, especially this many people in groups of 3, 4, 5, walking around outside in the middle of the day. So, but still, worldwide, this thing is doing something.
It's a monolith.
I wonder what Terrence McKenna would think of these machine elves and how they relate. It would be an interesting nod for his inner landscape. But yeah, Pokemon Go. There you have it.
The Chinese had Pokemon Go. It was a bunch of, you know, white and black stones that they laid across a grid.
So in America, obviously, have you spent time in the States?
Yeah, I have, for sure. My job that I just left at the beginning of the year in London was one that would take me to New York fairly regularly. We would go to California a bit and growing up, because I'm now on the other side of the ocean, so that's my flight over. But yeah, definitely.
Oh, we're in California.
I'm even an Americanophile, an Americophile. I actually like the place despite, you know, Washington.
Where do you go when you go to California?
Oh, it's been a long time. So I've been, we did quite a bit, actually. I've been to, this is a very long time ago, but yeah, LA, San Francisco, up the coast, went to San Diego, went skiing in Tahoe, okay. Which obviously is in California, but like, yeah, we got around.
Yeah, Tahoe's California, man.
Isn't, what was that?
Isn't Tahoe California? Yeah.
Is it? Or is it just
here. I'm yeah. close to well, San Francisco. I'm in Santa Cruz. So.
Well, then you'd know. Yeah.
Yeah, far out. Cool.
Obviously, we have to discuss the major Poke monster in America right now, Mr. Donald Trump. Obviously, it has to be on the world's radar. Or is it just sort of not that big a deal? Is this something that you have spent any time pondering?
Sure. He's an entirely expected thing at this sort of stage of the end of Anglo-American dominance. If it wasn't him, it would have been anything else. But it depends on who's doing the interpretation, because if you you know, if you live in Islington in London and you read The Guardian, then everyone is sort of pearl clutching and horrified at this idea. But of course they are, because they have that urban or urbane belief in centralization and the technocratic process. The idea that in some way Hillary, who is a criminal and a traitor and a murderer and a warmonger, is the better choice because Donald Trump is a ridiculous, you know, former bankrupt reality TV star. These two things don't follow. I mean, yeah, it's just what happens at this stage of the widespread dissatisfaction with a centralized and unlistening elite. I actually think he's going to win.
Yeah, it seems like that's where the chips are laying for the elite. Yeah.
And that will, let me be clear, that will be everybody's fault. That will be the War Party, which is obviously supporting Hillary. So it'll be the Democrats who actually put one of the most hated people in the country up against him. And it will, of course, be the Republicans who would, like, they thought, oh, yeah, Bush, what an excellent first choice we will have.
I actually blame Crowley myself, but yeah.
Well, there you go. But, like, when these things happen, it is entirely the fault of the centralized urbane elite who've spent the last several decades telling the non-urban elites that all their legitimate concerns to do with things like NAFTA and the hollowing out of the middle class are racist, and then all of a sudden you get a populist uprising. It's entirely their fault. It's the same thing we're experiencing in Europe right across the sort of Eurosceptic spectrum. And they turn around and blame populism. Oh, populism is rising. And I said, no, it's not. You've ignored the legitimate concerns of the majority of the population for three decades. Donald Trump is your fault. It just is.
He's a collective shadow. He's an emergence of people's own repressed kind of, you know, bigotry.
I don't even think it's bigotry. So
gives an excuse. You know, it's like if he says it.
At the moment, the American working class would vote for that cat that looks like Hitler. Anyone but Hillary, anyone but the existing structure that has genuinely told them that their concerns aren't real and that they're getting richer instead of poorer over the last three decades. The same thing happened. Like, so the divide in Britain over Brexit was London versus everyone else. This idea that it was sort of racist versus non-racist is not correct. All the benefits of the deregulation and widespread immigration flowed to London, and all the negative effects flowed to the rest of the country. And that's exactly what you're seeing with things like NAFTA and the general policies of a centralized East Coast elite, and West Coast in the case of Silicon Valley and so on. All the benefits flow to these people who have deregulated and dismantled the middle class, and they think everyone's racist because they're not the ones experiencing the extreme, you know, meteoric rise in wealth. Well, of course they aren't. They've harvested it from everyone else. And you turn around, I mean, the Labour Party in the UK did it all the time. Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, when people would ask, like, you know, we now have very high domestic unemployment in, you know, X named regional town. And the place has also had, 8,000 Polish visitors. If it wasn't the Poles before that, it was the Irish. It was like these people aren't the racist. It doesn't matter what color or creed they come in at, and they get turned around and told they're racist. This is the thing that's at an end. And the other thing on an almost spiritual level, it's just time. This is the end. We're in the death rattle of Anglo-American dominance moving towards a multipolar world, which could have emerged peacefully, but isn't, because these sort of 105 IQ psychopaths in Washington and to a lesser extent London don't want to relinquish control. So that's what I mean. If it wasn't Trump, it literally would have been the cat that looks like Hitler. They will vote.
But it has to be that, because it's fucking, it's the 16th Arcana, man. You got the Trump card, the tower, Trump tower, 16th Arcana, 2016. All it's like, that's, you know, that's the dynamics of the vacuum of the ninth gate or whatever. It's like we've taken the name and we've moved it over, and this is how it has to archetypally express itself in form. It has to be material expression from the, you know, what's happening below the surface, you know, or what's been put into place.
that's why I think he's going to win. I thought he was going to win last year when he was still, when, you know, Salon.com and the New York Times were still writing these teasing things, which is, it's genuinely teasing the majority of the population of America, the people who, you know, have had to leave Detroit. They're going, ha, 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 look at these morons voting for a reality star. How stupid are they? And I'm like, well, anyway. Yeah, I agree. I think
Hillary's logo shows Trump winning. I mean, essentially, you're looking at the two towers with a red arrow going from Gevorah to Chesed. So you have going from the severity to the mercy, but you have to cross through Gevorah in the 7-7 pathway, if you know what I'm referring to.
Sure, I do. You don't just think it's 9-11 like everyone else?
Well, I mean, it's Tisha B'Av. So, but yeah, you're seeing a replica, because we saw what we saw. We know what we know on one level, on a subconscious level, and then we're like, it's an expression of us catching up with ourselves. But it's like I can't tell. I'm like, is that they're that hip to it? I guess where they're like, oh, we're gonna give you the most archetypal, like, symbolic communication of basically you handing it over to make that leap, you know, to build that wire between the two towers, you know. And wow, I mean, I guess they don't want to take the middle route. They want to push everything to the left, blow up this fucking balloon, increase the tension until the thing pops, you know. And you know, I guess that's for power, that's for, you know, money or for whatever. But wow, what a way to go, man. I guess they've known for a long time that this is, you know, at this point in the eon, this is what we're supposed to be, not what we're supposed to be doing, but what we've decided to do. I mean,
it's just this is what happens at this stage of it. That's, yeah, I know exactly what but it feels like it too. It feels like it to people who are experiencing this. I have never, because obviously I was actually extremely pro-Brexit for a lot of the economic reasons, and also, like, I'm pro-Europe, which means I do not care for Brussels. My job was to deal with data policy and strategy on an international basis, and these people are insane technocrats, and that's like my kryptonite completely. But I didn't speak to anyone on either side of the spectrum who genuinely thought there was anyone on the world stage, probably other than Putin, where things were getting better. Like, they looked out across Europe and North America and Asia, and there isn't a leader where they're like, oh, well, you know, this person will maybe change things here or there. We universally feel that this is that stage of the movie.
Right.
Okay, so if you don't mind, I feel like there's, at least for me, there's a sort of subject that, and I want to be clear, I'm not trying to pigeonhole you into saying it's this or that, but maybe you can speak to the distinction here where, it would seem that there are people, an elite, at least some sort of control system that is certainly planning to make certain moves happen. And then there's also an emergence of either, as you were talking about, say, like the Trump or the Brexit, like this is just that scene in the movie, you know, like this is the next step in a very logical, quote-unquote, unintentional or unorchestrated event. And I would even take this, again, trying to take this back to your idea of, like, say, these star systems of what are we able to learn from watching the stars. This might sound like a weird tangent, but I just want to give you, like, a really, really super quick story. Is to say, years ago, before I had really studied any, like, esoteric symbolism, I was trying to, particularly Freemasonry, I was trying to do a story based on a square. It was basically a comic book project that I was doing, and I liked the idea of, like, well, everyone is living inside these little squares. How could I explore different, just that motif from an artistic perspective, how could I explore the motif of the square? And I just started realizing a few, I don't know, year or so into the project, that I had two pillars and a staircase in between them. The next sequence after that was like a waterfall. And then I just have this like sort of coffin feature. And I'm like, wait a second. After I learned about Freemasonry, I'm like, I know I didn't intentionally put this stuff in there, but by exploring the symbolism of the square, I intuited or decoded or whatever, I ended up laying out what are essentially the Freemasonic tracing boards in this story, right? And I was like, okay, well, here you have Freemasons who consider themselves square men. They are perhaps exploring this same archetype. We don't normally think of a geometric shape as an archetype, but if you get what I mean, of decoding this very basic symbol set and extracting something more complicated out of it. And it's where I started to realize, again, I could look at something on the world stage and say, oh, this is intentional. People say predictive programming, or this is some weird occult elite ritual that's being put into these movies or these whatever. And I just realized, I know I didn't do that. That was, again, unintentional, or perhaps unconscious. Perhaps there's a higher mental space that is aware of everything, you know, some sort of demonic aspect of the self or whatever. Again, any laundry list of explanations, but I think everyone in this call can sort of understand that there is multiple variables at play here. And when I heard you talking about looking at the stars and what sort of information are you able to extract, whether that was practical for their use or not, it reminded me of my experience with the squares and what extra sort of weird symbolic architecture I extracted from it. And I'm just curious, as you look at the world stage and as you look at your different studies with star systems, where do you find this balance, or can you just speak to this sort of either distinctions between or interplay between the intentional versus unintentional, or conscious versus unconscious?
Absolutely. This is essentially how much is, you know, conspiracy and how much is magic, or how much is just the universe. The universe has a waveform topology, which I think is probably quite important. And that's observable whether you're looking at time, whether you're looking at, you know, space or energy or so on. And it's interesting that some people who I, you know, over the last 150 years that I really admire have landed on in their own way this idea. Obviously, most recently, Martin Armstrong with his economic confidence model. Before that, Terence McKenna with Time Wave Zero, which is essentially the same idea. And I just love the idea of this radical art historian sitting down to an Apple IIgs trying to, you know, solve the physics of the universe because a mushroom told him. And further back, you have poets like William Butler Yeats with his gyres, and people are trying to. So these are intelligent and creative people who are trying to update an awareness that seems to be present in the whole kind of drive for calendrical systems in the first place, which is this waveform nature of reality. So in that respect, it is just time. That's what we're feeling. This is the end of the mandate of heaven has been withdrawn from the Anglo-American dominance of the world. Like, that's a sort of Taoist way of looking at it. We're moving into whatever comes next. It's very aeonic in that sense. Unfortunately, they do tend to be bouncy in those sort of between phases, which means as to which bits are controlled and which bits are just organic, the mandate of heaven idea is very useful. The previous methods of exerting Anglo-American dominance are getting less and less effective, and so they're doubling down on them. We're actually seeing them fail at ideas and fail faster. So things that are quite clearly ops, or quite clear, I hate the word false flag for reasons I'm sure you guys do as well, but ops and lies have a half-life that is shrinking. So something will happen, they'll attempt to do, and they'll get caught. And you know, usually it takes, like in a JFK sense, a decade or so before people kind of go, wait a minute. Now it takes a day. Yeah. The skills, the sort of demon skills that they've used to exert control are getting less and less effective. And that's actually where the danger is, because they only know how to do one thing. And as a result, they're doubling down on it. However, just the shape of the universe is shifting. So these things don't work anymore. And that's kind of where I see the planet doesn't have a singular, as far as I can tell, a singular governance system. The super elite of China do not sit down with the super elite of Europe and North America and kind of plan to minutiae levels what's going to be on TV next week. You have groups that are attempting, it's a Game of Thrones model, you have groups that are attempting to exert control. And the ones that have previously won most of the time, which is the Anglo-American elite, are failing.
Mm-hmm. That was very well said. Are you familiar at all with the 216 letter name? Do you know what I'm talking about? From the Book of Exodus, it's a Kabbalistic tool. And it corresponds to the Tree of Life. If you look in both, like, so if you're looking at the three pillars directly ahead, if you were to turn the whole tree sideways, you see another three pillars, right? The 216 letter name is three verses of 72 letters. So the first verse would be read right to left. The second would be read left to right. And the third would be read right to left again. But the way text I'm looking at with my teacher that I've been transcribing is describing the event of 9/11 and gives an explicit date. I get into this constantly now because it's my obsession, but it's basically describing what happens in consciousness when we go to look at the universe. We go through one level, and when we see the reverse, that expresses itself as corruption and conspiring. So it's pretty direct about it. So it's like you peer under the board and you're like, oh, what's going on? You see this corruption, you see this whole thing, you see the network and basically ego, essentially, and the way that expresses itself, substitute identity rather than our essential selves. And I'm saying you dive deeper beyond that, and then you come to the order that's beyond that. And so the way I can't help but just apply that is I'm like, you know, so many people who are, resonant with synchromysticism, who are attracted to synchronicity, started way more often than not with conspiracy theory. And one thing leads to another, because if you follow the route, you're looking at correspondences when you're looking at conspiracy. And so you're looking at intention, and you're like, oh, this person intended this and this person intended this. And you keep peering as deep as you can, you start to come across things that are really unexplainable, that you're like, baffle the mind. How the fuck is that possible?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So they express if you make a shift in the horizontal plane from the left and the right, that if it's a genuine shift, that the diagonals react, and that the verticals shift as well. So basically you can affect change. It's like as above, so below, so to speak. So if you're just relating to dimensions, if you unite the hemispheres in one direction, then the other one follows suit. And so I don't know. It feels really applicable here in terms of, like, we're saying, oh, is something intention? Is it conspiracy? Is it, underlying order, the dynamics of the vacuum of space or whatever? And it seems as though they're lines in the sand ultimately, and that's the big challenge, is that we can't really find where one ends and the other begins ultimately, though we can still recognize that there's that distinction. Does that make sense?
Absolutely it does. There's kind of layers to it. So I agree with you saying a lot of people. So the common criticism, which is leveled at, you know, conspiratainment or conspiracy theory aficionados, even though I, you know, reject that as a slave term, is that it's looking for a way to explain the world, like, because you can't handle complexity. I think that's the complete opposite. I think people who would actually listen to someone in a helmet hair wave on NBC tell them what's going on in a country neither of them will ever visit is the person looking for an explanatory, a safe explanatory model of the world. That said, sometimes it is correct. And the Chapel Perilous is a pass-fail IQ test. And you only look at... You can only look at sort of the deep state or what's going on behind the public sphere for so long before you start to see that there's things that aren't just, you know, common human conspiracy and personality behind it. And that's where the model starts to blur. And it's interesting because it kind of works on layers there. A lot of times people move into looking at deep state actions out of almost a sense of social justice. 9/11 was there so that you get things like the Patriot Act and global surveillance and so on. So people are angry at it at that level. And you kind of move up to, as you were saying, lines in the sand, which is, well, how much of this is just the in and out breath of the universe doing what it's doing and how much isn't. And you have this, you kind of have to move up to the level of, it always surprises people that mystics in the sense of, you know, desert mystics or monks or, you know, wandering Hindu holy men are so entirely apolitical. Like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I'm like, well, right. Surely it does if we're all God. And you go, well, no, because they've probably moved up and down.
No, they're going the vertical. They're not messing exactly. with Deborah. They're not even going near the 216 opposite the 72. They're just taking the direct route. Like that man who hasn't eaten since he was a child and he's in his 90s and he doesn't use the bathroom. He's, you know, and they did scientific studies on this man. That's a direct route. And he says it himself. He's like, it's the goddess. He's referring to, for lack of a better way to communicate it, you're like, that's Gimel. That's the high priestess. That's the vertical dimension. He's just bypassed the whole, you know, the whole lightning flash. He's not in the sense of the zigzag. He's just going straight because that isn't a diagonal pathway. The 13th diagonal. There is no 13th diagonal. There's 12 diagonals. You know, the Masonic G. That's the biggest joke in the world. You know, because you're like, that's not even what they have to pretend that isn't a spiritual dimension in order to establish the empire. It's how the whole thing operates.
Yeah.
And so it's this thing in our face all the time that we could just, you know, and how did that happen? I mean, Republican, Democrat, red and blue, Chesed Gevorah, like that blows my mind. It's like, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Did we do that or did they do that? But that's when Crowley wrote about the trance of sorrow, it's something you move past because the trance of sorrow implies feeling sorrow implies that there is something amiss in the universe. And at that kind of very top level, there probably isn't. It's going to do its in-breath and its out-breath and we are inconsequential. And it's a very difficult idea it's almost an oil and water idea to keep in the head with the microcosmic interest in, you know, improved freedom and improved exploration and so on. Because in the end, it's a trance of sorrow.
Right. Well, you know what? You just touched on my absolute favorite quote from Crowley, which actually reads more Vedantic than anything else, as far as I can tell, when he says, existence is pure joy, and failure to realize this is the cause of all sorrow, but that this isn't necessarily a misfortune because we invented sorrow, which doesn't matter so much after all, in order to have the realization that existence is pure joy and existence is thus a sacrament.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from Syncbook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.